This is Adrienne Hill. I'm a reporter with the public radio show Marketplace. We're talking about climate change as a cultural issue today with my lovely set of panelists. So is everyone in the right place, in the right room, and where they want to be? As I got started on this topic and thinking about this panel, I was trying to look at research and what was out there and really thinking about what does it even mean to say climate change is a cultural issue. And I came across this great reading list from Candace Oster and Paul Starr, who point out that there are all sorts of things we can mean climate change as culture. There's the way that culture causes climate change. There's the fact that we have a car culture and a consumer culture, that there's that sort of relationship. There's the way that climate change will alter culture and change the way that we live together in society and with each other. And finally, there's the way that culture actually helps create the decisions that we make and sort of helps shape the way individuals think about and make decisions about how to act in relationship to the environment and to ideas of climate change. And that's really what I wanted to explore today, is how do individuals connect to climate? How do they make decisions about it? And what can those things teach us as journalists about the ways we tell better stories, tell more compelling stories, tell stories that people connect with? And maybe different in new ways. So to help us answer those questions, I have Shazeen Attari, an assistant professor at Indiana University in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs.
Hello, Shazeen. Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming.
I have Michelle Hahngraf, who's an associate professor at, now help me get this right, Wageningen?
Yes,
University.
Very good.
in the Department of Economics of Consumers and Households. And I have Kenneth Broad, who's the director of the University of Miami's Abbott Center for Ecosystem Science and Policy and co-director of Columbia University's Center for Research and Environmental Decisions. Shazeen and Michelle also both work with CRED, so that is in part why we're all here. Thank you guys for coming and joining us. So it's my hope this will be a completely loose, open conversation. Ask each other questions, jump in, and we'll have lots and lots of time for audience questions, too. But to start, I thought you guys could each tell me a little bit about who you are, what you do, and what you make of the topic. Shazeen, do you want to start?
Sure. So my name is Shazeen Attari. It's a pretty unusual name. You guys can call me Shaz or Nintendo. No, I'm just kidding. I'm trained as an engineer, but I work most closely with psychologists and statisticians. So it's a very interdisciplinary environment. And I try to understand what do people think about energy. So we're sitting in this very cold, very lit room right now. Energy is constantly being transformed from heating to lighting to, you know, the stuff that we use to the computers that we're typing on. And the thing is, we don't really understand how much energy we're using minute by minute, day to day. So a lot of my work focuses on trying to make the invisible visible. I also try to figure out why is it that people don't act. So there's the information deficit model, which basically says, all right, I don't know, that's why I don't do, versus the motivation deficit model, which basically says, all right, it's not that I don't know, but it's that I'm not motivated to do the things that I should be doing. So, for example, I need cost incentives, effort, energy, things like that. So that's sort of the two models that I work on. Some of my research has also looked at when I ask people, what is the single most effective thing you could do in your life to conserve energy? Do they get it spot on? And what I found was that no, a lot of people think that the single most effective thing people can do is just turn off the lights rather than do some of the bigger behaviors that actually save a lot more energy. Additionally, people severely underestimate energy consumption for a lot of different devices and behaviors. So as journalists, how do we actually improve people's perceptions of energy consumption from underestimations to actually getting the estimations right? So that's the information deficit model, and then how do we motivate people so that they actually start conserving energy in their lives? So that's sort of the area that I work on. And if you have questions about people's perceptions about energy and how to motivate people, that's kind of what I've been working on for the past couple of years. Thank you.
Okay, my name is Michel Hahngraf, which don't even try to pronounce it. I'm Dutch. I work as a psychologist originally. I'm now in an economics department, but I still try to get some psychology into the equation. And what I look at mainly in my research is how people deal with climate change in terms of temporal trade-offs, first of all, which means people have to make trade-offs between now and later, which is a very difficult thing for people. I think Kenny will say a bit more about how we have two brain systems that don't always work that well together. One of them is the rational, and one of them is the quick and dirty one, let's say. And the quick and dirty one is frequently wants something now and wants it as soon as possible, whereas the rational system says or prescribes that we should wait longer and be more concerned with the future. And people are notoriously bad about that. There's research that I do on that aspect of environmental decisions. Another very important aspect of environmental decisions is the fact that it usually involves trade-offs between your own outcomes and other people's outcomes. So it's good for me to drive a big car and to be nice and cool inside this office, but for the rest of the world, it adds a little bit of CO2. And that's also something that people have a lot of trouble with dealing with, because they're not very good at these social dilemmas all the time. For instance, it's very difficult for us to know if we put in an effort to save CO2, whether other people would also do that. And people don't trust others to do it. That's why Kyoto, for instance, didn't go that well, I think, because the one country doesn't trust the other to actually do what they should do. And these trade-offs are very difficult. The third aspect of environmental decisions that I'm very interested in, and I think they always all combine in almost every environmental decision, is the fact that uncertainty is involved. So we don't know the exact outcomes of what's going to happen. We don't know exactly how much sea level rise there will be. And people can't really deal very well with uncertainties. People don't like them. They don't understand them. They can't think rationally about them. They worry a little, but not enough. I think Kenny will say some more about that. So those three aspects, the temporal trade-off, the social dilemma aspect of the environmental decisions, and the uncertainty are the things that I do research in.
And now?
No, I don't actually have to say much because they covered most of it. But I'm Kenny Broad, pronounced Kenny Broad. Easier. I guess let me just say a couple things and hopefully maybe push a couple buttons among the people from the media, which I assume is most people. There's a joke that's been around for a while, which is, why did God invent economists? I don't know if any of you heard it, but to make the climate modelers look good. I mean, it gets to, you know, the central point. You can deconstruct the joke on, you know, various ways, but it's about uncertainty. And there's uncertainty on the climate science side, and there's uncertainty on the human behavior side. That's, you know, what Michelle referred to is we have these two systems in our brain, you know, the analytic side, the newer, the neocortical structures, and then the older parts of our brain that respond more on instinct, and instinct often wins, and that's why we tend to, you know, at least talk about it, that we have bounded rationality. And so that uncertainty, it gets used, as you all know, many different ways. There's kind of the purposeful strategic use of uncertainty that plays out with, you know, the political battles, the ideological battles, where, you know, the university is a big left-wing conspiracy and, you know, in cahoots with NPR. No one's ever been to a university faculty meeting. They can't even agree on, like, what to paint the bathroom door, let alone, you know, to try to get consensus on a scientific project, but put that aside. So there's this kind of purposeful strategic use of uncertainty, but then there's the psychological ways that we deal with uncertainty, that we are probably less conscious about how we behave, and we're very much affected by, for example, how something is framed. And that's where the media is very interesting, and quite frankly, the media is often used as a pawn in framing and in the strategic use of uncertainty. Where, just to give very brief examples, it's the, you know, often the media follows the he said, she said model, which implies a perfect 50-50 balance in two opposing positions, which doesn't reflect the scientific consensus. And then there's framing for different worldviews, how we want to have our confirmation bias, or we listen or we accept the information that reinforces our particular worldviews, and that's, you know, sometimes as a result of how the media portrays things. So whether, you know, climate change is framed as a tree-hugging environmental movement, is it framed as a moral movement where, for the, you know, someone with religious beliefs might be more amenable. What Would Jesus Drive was an interesting SUV campaign, I think, that shows that. So the framing issue, I think, is a central one to the cognition. Humans are not great intuitive statisticians. We don't do great with probabilistic information, and there's, lots of examples, some of it from the research that both of my friends have done. And there's the spatial and temporal dimensions of climate change that are very difficult, that we don't do well worrying about things. We don't perceive risk of something far out in the future or that's spatially not very close to us from a psychological sense. Is it going to hurt my public health, my personal health, or my family's health? Which climate change was not framed, for instance, like the ozone hole, which will instantly give me cancer and things like that, where you had a lot more visceral reaction. So there's tons of, you know, these cognitive biases. I'll be quiet now, but hopefully they'll come out as we try to answer questions.
So a lot to think about. We have a lot we could talk about, but let me start then with this idea of framing, because I think as journalists it's something we probably all think about a lot. How do we frame the story in a way that more people are interested in what we're saying, that more people can connect to what we're saying? What do we know about the ways people connect to climate change and the ways maybe they don't connect? What strategies are effective ways to frame these and what aren't? Why don't you start us up, Kenny, and then we'll...
We're better at saying what doesn't work than what works, but there's an interesting study, and I really encourage people to look at two documents, or two websites anyway. One of them is the Yale Project on Climate Change, by another one of our colleagues, Tony Lazarowitz, where he identifies what he calls six Americas, and these are six different interpretive communities, meaning kind of distinct, you can distinguish different worldviews, and talks about which framings work for those. So, you know, you can frame climate change as a national security issue. So there's an interesting, he did an interesting study where he looked at different political groups, including Tea Party members, and all of them were in favor of action towards renewable energy, but for different reasons, not for climate change, but rather for national security for some groups. So it's know thy audience,
right,
which is a tough deal for you guys because, you know, you don't want, you're supposed to be objective. So are you catering your information for a particular audience? Which often you'll take our probabilistic statements or climate scientists' probabilistic statements and make them sensationalistic, or at least deterministic, rather. Then the editor makes them sensationalistic. And then, because it sells media, and then we feel undermined, it causes confusion in the public.
Right.
And so the framing issue is, I'm more curious how the problem on your end as opposed to on our end, but I defer to
smarter people. What do you guys think? I mean, what kind of framing works? So we said we know a little bit about what kind of framing doesn't work.
Well, so I think it depends on which group you're addressing, and that's a very difficult problem because any general message is always going to just work for one of the groups, not for all of them. I recently did a study where I gave people incentives to conserve energy, and one of the things that came out of that study is, and these were highly motivated people, this was a firm on green consultancy, so they're highly motivated to save the environment, however you want to call that. And it turned out that giving them money for saving energy didn't work at all with them, whereas giving them a compliment in terms of a grade point every week for how they did, that did work. And one of the interesting things that comes out of that study is that for this group, what I call the social cue worked better than the monetary one.
And this is, again, a group of people who are very motivated already.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so in another study, I've shown that this only works for those people that are highly motivated. People that are not very motivated, they are better motivated by monetary incentives, for instance. So it's quite difficult. If you want to convince people, you have to know who they are, basically.
Or give money and grades.
That's interesting because that's not how it works. They're actually just adding the money to the grade makes the effect of the grade go away. Because people are... I think the reason that people didn't do it for the money is because they were annoyed about the fact that they were being paid for something they would morally already do. They don't want to seem like somebody who is just doing that for the money. And therefore, adding the money doesn't work. So it's really not true that there's one... that there's some combination of frames that works for everybody. It's really difficult in that sense.
Just to add to that, there are multiple frames that work, but there's some frames that don't work. So, for example, I think we've seen I believe it was Time magazine had a cover story of a polar bear sort of almost about to drown, right? The problem with polar bears is, when was the last time you saw a polar bear in its natural environment? Anyone just raise your hand. The reason why I bring that up is because you need frames that can impact the individual, so that the individual can relate to. You need multiple frames. So actually saving energy is a double dividend, right? So it's good for the environment, it's good for your own economic budgets. It's good for a variety of different things. So reframe the problem in the way that it sort of adapts to your audience, but also use frames that are very visible to your audience.
What do you mean by frames that are visible to your audience?
So for example, don't use a polar bear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or a penguin.
Just that they have everyday encounters.
So I think one of the big challenges that scientists have right now is trying to make impacts of climate change, even future impacts of climate change, visible to people. So for example, I have a project that I'm working on, but it's a very challenging project, trying to sort of make visible the invisible. Like, so for example, how do you speed up time so that people can experience climate change, so that they understand what is going to happen in the future? But the impacts of climate change in the future are very uncertain, so how do you sort of also explain uncertainty to people?
And I guess that brings me to my next question, which is really about the temporal issue. I think, Michelle, you said the now and later brain, the quick and dirty brain.
Yeah.
I mean, how do we as journalists try to talk about the future in a way that is meaningful when there is so much uncertainty about exactly what that future is?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. I think there's a lot of things like education involved in this. I mean,
right.
People have to learn these things. It's not something that they can readily understand. Right? One of the things that you could do as a government, which is being done, for instance, in the Netherlands, is subsidizing things, so making sure that things happen now rather than later. So, for instance, saving $100 over the next 10 years on your energy bill by buying a more expensive refrigerator is something that people don't do because they want the $50 off the price now rather than the $100 over the lifespan of the refrigerator. If you make sure that they get those $100 now, that's the future becomes the now, and then they do take it into account. I don't think it's very easy to actually make people concerned about the future more because it's just not in the way we think. We're not. And I think Alfred Weber has said this before, we're not made to think about this problem. This is too slow, too far off. We're meant to deal with predators that come out of the bush, or maybe even think ahead a year in saving some food for next year, or things like that, originally, like when we were still in the wild. And it doesn't work with these long-term problems that change very slowly. And that's just something we have to deal with and make sure people understand that they make these mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, to follow up on that, just what Michelle was saying, we've kind of evolved from trial and error sort of learning. We haven't had this event. I mean,
right.
It's not a repeatable event that's been repeated in during human span. But how many people are from Florida here? Or South Florida? Quite a few, and I'm sure the other people are pretty environmentally savvy, but we did a survey of Floridians, and actually their temporal dimension on when global warming, you can call it global warming or climate change, by the way, just to change it, was occurring, and we compared it 5 years later, and it was, people believed it was happening now or within 10 years, a much higher percentage than the past, which was encouraging on that dimension. But where there wasn't change was on the spatial dimension of how close it was to you. It was still going to happen somewhere else. You know, the melting ice, the distant land, where South Florida is probably, or at least by most accounts, and there's a good OECD economic report, it's the only, Miami's the only city in the quote developed world that is in the top 10 vulnerable, most vulnerable. So, you know, Floridians are still associating it with the melting ice. You know, it gets 2 degrees hotter here, big deal. You know, it's freezing usually. I do apologize for the cold weather today. So, you know, how do you frame it where you feel like you have a personal connection to it? It doesn't mean a threat, but look at when we did our survey and asked what likely impacts. The only thing people really said was the very likely impact of global warming was increased hurricanes. That's probably the least defensible scientifically. Okay? So that's a very weak. You could get a bunch of scientists who believe strongly in global warming would argue what the effect on storms will be, intensity or frequency. But we probably wouldn't argue on sea level rise, which is a 1,000-pound gorilla for Florida, for not only for our marine ecosystem, tourism, not only for our beaches, tourism economy, but for our fresh water supply, which you get a little closer to a human health issue. So none of these, you know, these, they're not even that complex connections, are not being made explicit. That's something that I think would help at least in a lot of places.
And maybe that's where the polar bear actually does some harm, right?
The polar bear thing did harm also because that particular polar bear was taken out of context. That picture that went around the media, so it's more fodder for those who are saying, you know, that things are fake in the media. So.
And I just wanted to ask about another dimension to this problem. So, for example, it also matters who the messenger is. So there's a huge partisan divide right now between what Democrats think and what Republicans think in terms of whether climate change is happening and whether humans are causing it. So 66% of Democrats believe that climate change is happening and that humans are causing it, but only 32 to 33% of Republicans think the same. Now, I'm not sure why there's this huge partisan divide. It could be because, you know, they do not like Al Gore. It could be about, you know, what's happening with the GOP debates right now. But we need to sort of figure out how to bridge that divide and sort of get everyone together on the same sort of track in order to address this problem. And that's sort of where the media comes in. So if you guys have solutions, I'd love to hear them.
And before, this point that Shad's making is really important, but it's also, it can be misinterpreted. When you look at trust in the provider of information, scientists across all four parties, so include Tea Party right now, is scientists come out highest, which is great. But the problem is what they think scientists are saying. Okay? So, and that's where the media, the he said, she said, I believe, gives a false view of the degree of consensus on the climate change problem. So yes, I trust scientists, but there's lots of scientists who disagree with high statistics showing, high numbers showing that people perceive disagreement among the scientists.
And there is no...
I mean, why do you call a scientist?
And yeah, let's go into questions.
Yes,
well, there's one issue on the he said, Andy Repkin, there's one issue on the he said, she said that makes this very tough, which is, what's the question? Is the question, is climate change dangerous? There you have a lot of consensus on the basics. But if the question is about, as you said, are things, is there's legitimate, real, unmanufactured debate. But so how do you use a hurricane example or many other regional impacts are uncertain.
In fact, like all of the things about this problem that are most relevant to society are the least certain, where the scientific community is debating. So one of the first things, and even in the way surveys are done, defining their terms, defining the language, when you do your surveys on global warming, are you specifying anthropogenic, you know, human-caused warming?
Sure.
Obviously, but usually in the public discourse on this,
it's all
mashed out.
That's right.
So there's no real common sense of what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, depending on, you know, what your audience is willing to accept and how much you can fit into an article, you can say that, I mean, or scientists can get trained to say, I believe there are threats from climate change, but on this particular specific, I'm unable to say with certainty
that's
when and how.
Training.
That's right. You've got training of journalists.
And do you guys actually mind identifying yourself
first? George Gonzalez, University of Miami. I'll say this. I believe this. It's not meant to be provocative. It's tried, but not meant to be provocative. This is entirely the fault of the media. Not the journalists, but the media. And Exhibit A.
You say this is entirely the fault,
public misunderstanding, whatever division exists in the public, not understanding the risks, not understanding the time or the physical dimensions of the risk, this is entirely, in my estimation, the fault of the media. You know, the fact that my students will say, well, you know, if the climate science is so clear and so settled, right, why is it that Republican Party nominees, presidential nominees, can go around denying it? And I say it's entirely the fault of the media. Because the media is underreporting it, misreporting it, misspinning it. You know, if humanity survives into the 22nd century, and that's it, if humanity survives in the 22nd century, and after going through climate catastrophe, I'm certain that people will say, okay, the media colossally failed. And again, what is Exhibit A? An article just a few days ago on the New York Times reporting on how aggressive Arctic ice is melting. Right now, if you understand climate science, you would view this as the beginning of the end. The fact that climate science, that climate, that ice in the Arctic is melting as aggressively as it is, you know, I'm like, you know, we're looking at the unraveling. We're from switching of a cold house system to a hot house system of Earth climate, which is a fundamental, profound threat to humanity in every dimension. But the New York Times, instead of taking this melting of Arctic ice, and you have these ice-free summers, now we're talking about within 30, 40 years, instead of focusing on the danger of it, and really what it means in profound sense for the global ecosystem, instead the focus of the article is how this is creating economic opportunity.
Shipping channel.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, I told my students, I said, you know, really, it just shows the maliciousness, and it really is, the malicious treatment of this issue. And I
compare it. Malicious about? Is it true? It's an economic opportunity.
Well,
they have the right to do whatever they want.
Well, I don't know if they have the right, but let me put it this way. It's in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, this is what I told my students. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, can you imagine if the news media, instead of playing up the foreign policy dimensions of it, instead said, oh, this is a great boost to the undertaking industry in New York City. Look at how all the undertakers are making some great dollars out of this. And it was a depressed market, and it's really being boosted. I mean, you know, what would we say about that? But that's malicious, it's morose,
but
it's
it is
moral.
Part of the story. I mean, it is part of the story. You know, well, even the undertaking business in New York, I mean, you could say it is part of that story.
Yes, okay, it's okay to call
it. NPR would probably the undertaking.
It's okay to call it.
For sure, part of what is
There's something disingenuous in that, right? Because, of course, if the thrust of the, if all the news media, you know, raise the alarm bell and raise the red flag saying, okay, the melting of Arctic ice, now this is really dangerous.
Right.
We really need to understand exactly what this means, exactly what this means for humanity. And fine, there's some back page story on the economics of it, right? I mean, fine, there'd be no objection there. But, you know, the fact that the story on the New York Times, and I really have to wonder how other news organizations are covering this, if at all. They're probably not.
Well, so journalists, I believe the New York Times. Are New York Times representatives?
We wrote reams of stories about Arctic change, and this is one story from Andrew Kramer in Moscow about reality that's happening. The economics, the reality of our species is that we're both opportunistic and we're proactive. I mean, not proactive. Opportunistic and defensive. When something happens to the environment, we look for an opportunity, and we also look to defend ourselves. So saying that that's off limits, or saying that every article about shipping the Arctic has to include some big chunk about the other aspects, I think is unrealistic. You have to look at the cover.
I think you're misconveying what I'm saying.
And by the way, I would love to Skype in with your students, so follow up with me.
But this woman in the back has been so patiently waiting. Can you identify yourself?
Heather Dewar, a freelance environment writer. And I guess I'm going to frame this in the context of a question. This discussion between Andy and...
George.
Is perfectly illustrative of a serious problem, which is a lack of trust and understanding the commonality of purpose between journalists and scientists. The fact of the matter is the Times has done many front page stories about Arctic ice, and George sees the story that disturbs him, which is very common. Many scientists do that and focus on that story.
Is there a commonality of purpose between scientists and journalists?
I think there is. I think we basically, in a fundamental sense, we're both striving, fumbling by trial and error, by putting out theses and waiting for the other members of our community to knock them down towards the truth, towards some fundamental truth that's going to serve the purpose of a social purpose, a higher social purpose. And we use really a lot of the same methods, just on radically different timescales. And we have a much higher tolerance for error than you guys do.
And so what's your...
I'm not sure who should be more embarrassed, the scientists or the journalists.
The Aldo Leopold Institute at Stanford is working on trying to train some of the newsroom leaders. And one of the problems really is that we've got environmental journalists here who get it, but they answer to people who come from a background in politics who don't get it and don't understand scientific uncertainty. And I guess my question is, how can we do more to build trust and communication between people who are working in very difficult economic and social environments who pretty much have a common purpose.
What do you guys think?
How can we find a common purpose between journalists and scientists? I think one of
trust.
Yeah, in terms of trust. I think one of the main issues here is that there is a difference in purpose, which is scientists are, we're trying to figure out things, and that's basically what we do. Journalists are at least on some dimension, forced to sell their stories.
And there's a
difference between those two things, and one of them is that a negative message, like the one you just painted, like this is a really big problem, is something that doesn't sell very well. It sells one time maybe, but this is a problem that's never going to go away for the next 100 years, and it's a bad problem. It's very negative. People don't like to hear about it every day. You don't see that on the news ever about any problem, where it comes back every day again and again and again, because people stop watching it. They close themselves off. This is a psychological mechanism that we have, which protects us against too much negative information. We just don't want to deal with it anymore. So in order to be able to sell something, you have to stop giving the same message time and time again if it's negative. So by definition, it's almost impossible for journalists to keep doing that. And as scientists, we don't care whether somebody reads our stuff.
I disagree on certain things. They are more cynical. But we do sell our science. We frame our results. That's 100% sure. We have PR offices in our universities, all of them. And we sell our science. But there's a much stronger, I think, check and balance system in the peer review system, where we're also paid to shoot down our colleagues' papers and ideas. And that's our bread and butter. It's not agreeing. It's actually challenging.
Right.
And we have the time and luxury to do that, at a more thorough level than you do in journalism, when you hand something in that's got to be out, the next day, and that's a long time to make a problem for you. So I think there's some fundamental differences there, but we still try to, for many reasons, sell our science.
You're right, but it's not the main purpose of what we do.
No, I think we're drawn into it for different reasons.
Yeah.
Then not paying the glory.
In the back there, Nancy Gaspar with Spark Connect for the local government. You were talking a little bit about temporal aspect, and you were also talking about framing temporal aspects. And what I see is that temporal aspect is different for different groups. For a elected official, it might be their term of office. For someone who's about to buy a house, it's the term of their mortgage, the 30-year mortgage. For someone who just had grandchildren, it's the lifetime of that new addition of their family. So could you talk a little bit more about framing in the temporal context for issues like that?
Can you repeat the question? I don't know who wants to jump in here first.
Sure, I'll try. So I guess your question was how the effect of framing in terms of a temporal context for climate change. It's a hugely important problem when we're making decisions, when we're making a purchasing decision on whether I want to actually think about installing a particular device in my home or weatherizing my home. It's really important when we're making a political stance. The thing is, we're constantly in different modes of time. So even when you think about doing something good, there's this project that I'm working on that tries to figure out, is it the single action bias? So is it that I just want to do one good thing and feel like I've done my part for climate change? Or is it something that we can actually get people to feel, all right, I'm going to do one thing, two things, three things, I feel really good about it, and then I start incorporating a lot of these different behaviors. But it's really hard to figure out what time frame people are in, because we're constantly shifting time frames. So I'm not sure if that's a clear answer or if it's more of a question back to you.
Just to provide some clarification, I guess my question is, I know of a number of different temporal frames that we often use to try to sell the message of save energy or think about climate change. Are there other temporal frames that you've seen used effectively that might help a group like this have additional reference points?
Well, I've seen less effective use of different temporal frames than we've seen, I'll give examples, effective use of policy mechanisms, particularly one you may have heard of that's getting popular called choice architecture or decision architecture. And the idea being you can structure a decision in a way that the default is the one that gets people to make the decision for a better time frame. So in other words, if you sign up at the university for a 501 or 401k, whatever it is, you know, there's a default for savings for retirement. Now, if you made that default higher, but you had the option to do something, you know, that was more risky, you'd have a lot more people doing the, what we would say, more conservative social good, which is being prepared for getting older or whatever. So those sorts of decision architecture, opt-in, opt-out things, can be built into mortgages, they can be built into insurance programs, and people are proposing these, and there's some, you know, very good evidence in certain areas. So to answer your question, it's harder to get people to switch their time frame thinking than it is to trick them into making the default a longer time frame. Does that make any sense, Nancy? Here.
And in the blue shirt.
Hi, Jeff Gavin with the Public Radio's Living on Earth. The question has to do with extreme weather events and how useful they are as a way to frame thinking about global warming is strong in the effort. I have had experience to, you know, say, look at that tornado. Look at that hurricane, look at that dust storm, climate change is here. What's your advice on how to handle that, how useful it is as a way of framing thinking about global warming? Because it certainly does get people's attention. People love weather, and they're very interested in extreme weather, and it's one of those potential events.
Can they living it out? It's something they experience. Yeah. What do you think?
I mean, these sorts of signal events really can backfire, and they don't have lasting effects. I mean, the example was the 2010 heat wave. Everyone's saying global warming, but then you have the ice storms that come in the end of 2010. Then you have ice storms. I mean, this happens all the time. So then, look, there's no global warming. It's cooling, we're freezing, we're having ice storms. So people are very susceptible, not only to priming effects of big events, but when you ask them about global warming, if you crank up the heat in the room versus make it a very cold room, you're going to get different susceptibilities. So I think they're very dangerous. They can be used both ways. They do get both used by both sides of, you know, the coin. And then Andy's point, which is, if you ask me as a scientist, was that active hurricane season a result of global warming or that particular hurricane? There's no way I'm going to say yes. So then people throw the whole global warming baby out with bathwater often. It's not a qualified statement, you know, which often goes making a qualified test. Kind of makes sense. So, and there's lots of evidence from the strong El Nino events and others that you get a big spike in media coverage and then it goes away.
It's Anna Maris here, freelance journalist. My question, I guess, is not that related to journalism. It's just something I'm curious about. I mean, it's about the sort of influence of, I guess, like subcultural or tribal or group affiliation on people's behavior. So what I'm really interested in these days is this sort of cult of personal eco-sainthood that you see in a small group of American and Europeans who will go to great lengths to improve their own personal impact and kind of bike everywhere and reuse everything, but it's all just contained within them, and it doesn't seem to spread. And I almost even worry that if the behaviors became more widespread, they would cease to be a marker for that particular group, and then they would no longer have that kind of power. So I'm curious to know what you guys make of this sort of phenomenon of a small group of people who seem to flout the general trends about not being able to look, you know, or sacrifice or something. Do they do this just because they're part of the club? And if so, what happens if the club gets too big?
So I can try to answer that a little bit. So there's this phenomenon in social psychology called in-group versus out-group effect. And so, and that's also another problem with climate change, is because we're not fighting against aliens or something like that. There's no out-group that we're fighting against. Right? So when I'm in a particular group, my social identity is formed by that, by my affiliation. So that's why that sort of makes me want to do the things that my group does. So that is extremely powerful. I'm not quite sure what happens when N gets really, really big, when your group gets really, really big, and the out group is not as powerful, then the social identity falls a little bit. So that can be problematic. But actually what you're talking about, this whole phenomenon of voluntary simplicity, it's very powerful, and a lot of people are sort of talking about that as sort of the red pill versus the blue pill of technology, right? So either it's technology that's going to save us, or we all need to really change our lifestyle. And so which one of these two futures is sort of going to take hold? But that's sort of an open question.
Another thing that happens in these types of situations is that this behavior becomes more normal within a group. So you get a few people doing it, and then as the group grows, apparently it becomes the norm to be greener, so to speak. And this is a very important thing, because it turns out that people are very strongly motivated by norms. As I said before, I did that study where I gave people social rewards instead of money, and it turns out that that's a good motivator. So people are very strongly motivated by what do other people around me do, what do other people in my group do. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that this is probably a much stronger motivator than money. There was a study done a while ago where they asked people to predict what would motivate them the most to behave, to conserve more energy. And if you ask people that and you give them different options, the one that always comes out at the top is saving money. They always say, I'll save money, and that's the best motivator for me. And then what these researchers did is they subsequently gave people either focus them on the money they were saving, or they would tell them what their neighbors were doing. And then if you look at the effects of what actually happens, it turns out that these people that got information about their neighbors saving energy actually saved much more energy than the people that were focused on the money. We think we're economic animals, but we're social animals, and people don't really know. So I actually think that it's not a huge problem if this N becomes too large, because what will just happen is that this behavior becomes a norm. It becomes normal. People want to adapt to that. They want to also do it. And then these few people that want to be slightly different will start doing different things, but that's still a small group. So maybe for these individuals it's not as lucrative anymore to be that green person if it becomes normal, but still for the environment it's better.
Okay. We'll go here first, and then we'll go to the
second
question.
Yes. Okay. Christy George, I'm a TV producer. And I'm curious what past campaigns or things that have turned into social movements or social changes, behavioral changes, like quitting smoking or the reverse case, you know, refusing vaccinations, where people, you know, something has started small and grown into a trend. Do you study those? What are the ones that you find to be the most powerful and useful?
What are the kind of change behavior campaigns that historically have been successful? And some of the example that I can think of, and you kind of mentioned two of them, which are the ones that hit close to home with health. So smoking, the obvious one, and vaccines is the other obvious, unfortunate example. And then in the climate realm, I guess the closest one is the ozone hole with CFCs. So, and again, it's because I think I mentioned earlier, people associated that with skin cancer. They, you know, got worried about their kids. You had a much bigger outpouring of concern from mothers. And the climate change hasn't been framed as a human health issue. And it's human health is somewhere far away. It's not about, hey, you know, disease vectors related to mosquitoes are going to start changing and coming to places. We're going to have malaria in South Florida, those sorts of potentials. So I don't, you know, for me, it's a direct, being able to see direct human health impact, not necessarily a giant scare tactic, but at least salient.
All right, and so we have a couple here in the back, and then Andy, and then in the middle there.
So mine isn't so much a question, just a comment or a response to something that you said.
You might identify yourself.
Sorry, my name is Susan Morris. I'm a longtime journalist who now works for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And you were talking earlier about framing in real life examples, and also the concern about negativity, about so many of the stories about climate change are relentlessly negative. The Fish and Wildlife Service did something fairly unusual this year in trying to offer some real life on the ground examples around the country, 50 states, things that people could see that were in front of them, that were happening that related to climate change, and then efforts of people, whether volunteers or staff, to try to respond to them from the trying to stem some of the erosion of habitat in North Carolina, like in Cape Romaine National Wildlife Refuge, to efforts at Prime Hook Refuge in Delaware to deal with the decline of red knots, which is their migratory birds that fly up. They're dependent on the spawning of horseshoe crabs, and they've been a problem with the decline of horseshoe eggs. Anyhow, there are a whole lot of efforts going on. The examples are out there, and I wonder why we don't see more about. Why don't I see more of those stories in the paper about efforts that are out there that exist in every state where people are trying there are real physical effects and they're trying to counter them, to control them, to the degree that it's possible.
And just a comment back.
Could you please repeat the question, a short version of the question?
Question. Sure. It's more of an example to make visible these impacts that are happening in people's backyards, basically. And I think making those impacts visible would be very, very powerful. So I'd love to talk to you more about that.
And another comment on that is there's recent research in psychology that shows that one of the things you always try to do, maybe as a journalist or as a policymaker, is scare people into action. Which is not a great tactic because people don't like to be scared, so they will just ignore the information. It turns out that one of the better ways to motivate people to actually take some action is by giving them information on how to change things. And there, I think the backyard problem comes into focus again, because if you give people small things to do around in their own areas that actually work, that gives a much better incentive to do something than something remotely distant, really scary, that you want to ignore. For instance, I think that we all remember the tsunami in Asia where there was a lot of money being given to that good cause from all over the world. Whereas if there's a hunger somewhere in Africa, which is probably causing a lot of deaths as well, it's also a huge problem. Not many people are giving to that, not as many as to the tsunami. And the main reason, I think, is because the tsunami seemed like something we could do something about. Like, this is all destroyed. If we give them money, they can rebuild, and they're okay again. The hunger problem in Africa is like a bottomless pit. You keep throwing in money, and it just doesn't work. So that's why people stop doing anything. And with the climate problem, I think it's something similar. You can give people small examples of their local environment where they can do something, and they will actually feel that they can do something.
I would love you guys to comment on, especially from the social science perspective, is how much of people's response to these issues is essentially hardwired. Paul Slovic talks about the feeling of risk. In other words, we make our risk calculations not based on data, almost all the time, but based on emotional responses and cues and background and development. And by the way, I did think his work is vital for anyone on the screen.
Yeah.
Because the same set of reflexes that makes people scared of global warming has made them scared of some of the solutions, whether it's more power lines or natural gas, or in some cases, some kinds of nuclear power. So the same community that is worried is also worried about some of the actions, and that has very unrealistic expectations about some of the other things.
What's that other
thing? Paul Slovic. S-L-O-V-I-C.
I mean, his...
Can you repeat the question?
How hardwired are our responses to some of these threats are essential innate risk perception? And I think the answer is very hardwired.
Including the variability in the action. Like a communitarian versus libertarian seem pretty hardwired as well.
Right, but I think, well, to maybe try to answer it more succinctly, at least in Paul's work, where he was looking at technological risk, you know, it's the dread factor in how familiar we are with the technology. So if we're familiar with something like a trampoline or a lawnmower, which kills a lot more people
or injures a lot more people, certainly handguns, alcohol, probably cell phones now on the road. They don't evoke dread. They're common. We kind of understand how they work versus something like nuclear, which has this very, you know, evokes dread, and we don't understand much. But climate change is a hard one. It doesn't fit in clearly in his matrix because it's something we don't know about and has potentially catastrophic thoughts, but it's hard for us to envision, like Chaz was saying, this very personal impact. It's not my skin melting and getting cancer within a few years. So it's a very, you know, it's difficult. You don't want to, you know, scare tactics don't necessarily work well. Some of the alternatives are very uncomfortable to consider, so it's a difficult one to
end. And also just to add to that, Andy, is that some of the sort of the solutions to climate change that people are sort of working with, that's, you have CCS, which is carbon capture and sequestration, things like geoengineering, we don't really have that much experience with. So again, it's a technology that I don't know much about. So again, my feelings of risk are very, very high. But then, sort of keeping that on the side, there are also a lot of individual differences when it comes to risk. So for example, females are much more willing to take social risk than men, but men are much more willing to take financial risk than women. So there's both a lot of individual differences when it comes to risk, but when you're dealing with unknown things, your feelings of risk are very, very high.
In the back, in the middle there. You know that line of the president of the Philippine Network of Environmental Journalists. I come from one of the most vulnerable countries in the world. I've been doing a lot of interviewing farmers, fishermen at the grassroots level, and most of the time I ended up studying the complexities of climate change, so being like a scientist before I got to interview them. But my question is, how do we avoid the term climate change, because we're talking to the local people, and laymanize things or stories to convey more people, readers, subjects?
That's a great question. So the question was, how can we avoid using the term climate change?
And should we? And should we?
And I think there's really good evidence from on the ground, things that have been happening, particularly with ranchers and grasslands and other areas, by calling it environmental change. Because people who are out there every day recognize changes. And, you know, part of it is how do we make ourselves less vulnerable to change? I don't care if you call it climate change or it's vulnerability because God is controlling, just doing forcing the variability. So it's know thy audience. So climate change just resonates ideologically, at least in the United States, with people as, you know, they don't listen to the message. Once you've said climate change or global warming, even worse. If you talk about environmental change with the kinds of decisions they make, whether is it you have to plant earlier now because there's been a change, or can you not grow the same crops? You know, people are willing to get into a dialogue and to start. There are good examples of that from them.
If I can add to that, we've done some research also in Argentina with farmers where also in Uganda, it turns out that using groups for this type of information is a very good idea. So if you get people together, like if they're a village or they are organized in some way, and you get them to talk about, I mean, maybe you shouldn't call it climate change, but about this topic, they will actually explain to each other in terms that they understand themselves. This is one big advantage of approaching groups rather than individuals. And another good reason for doing that is because different processes occur when people have to make decisions when they're in a group. One of them is that I said something about the trust, about knowing what other people will do around you. I mean, if I'm going to be good to the environment, it's going to cost me a little bit. And if I'm the only one, it's no use anyway. So getting people together in groups or villages or as farmers' organizations, talking to each other, they can actually develop trust and know that they're not the only one doing something about this, or not the only one worried about this. And it's much easier to convince people of the social dilemma that's involved when you use groups for this.
Can you have any thoughts about language, just sort of the language we use to talk about it at all?
I think the language we use is really, really important, and I think that I feel just to certain audiences, climate change, the actual term climate change has become so politicized that we need to reframe it. You know, I've heard people talk about environmental disruption, climate disruption. You know, so there's a whole variety of different frames that I've heard actually from the media. So,
Are you guys comfortable with those changes? If you say climate disruption or environmental change, as scientists, are you like, or future?
I like environmental change. Personally, I think a lot of things are blamed on climate that you can't necessarily blame on climate. And I mean, I know this is a climate session we're in, but there's a lot of threats to ecosystems and human health that are going on every day that have nothing to do with climate, where we're getting affected right now, whether it's, you know, endocrine disruptors from getting flushed through our systems out in, you know, into the water, you know, whether it's, I mean, here in Miami, where we're still taking out mangroves in lots of areas for development. So you want to worry about climate change, or you want to worry about our current, you know, variances to building codes? I mean, there's stuff that happens. Nancy, who works in the, you know, in the trenches on that stuff, I'm sure can tell you. So I think in some ways, putting everything on climate is disrupting from more acute threats that are going on right now. So I don't want us to say climate's not an issue, obviously, but I think it's a fine balance.
Yes. My name is Patricia. I'm actually my daughter's guest. She's the one that interested in all these topics. But as a mother of four, I would like to know, like you say, we are, most of ours here, not the youngest generation, are making this switch in our brains about trying to save, you know, energy, things like that. We're switching our mind. We weren't raised like this, right? Most of us were just raised more, not so much into video games, things like that. And now I always make fun with my husband, like, these kids, they know how to use the iPads, they know how to use the remote control, they can use computers. We have to learn all these things. Are there any studies or things like that to see that the kids' mindsets are actually, not that they're born different now, but they're more into all these environment things. Like my kids here in school about saving the earth, right, turn on the light, the water, why you can brush your teeth, little things like that. And you mentioned something about there's bigger things that they can be done, just not just turning off the lights, but helping the media or shows teach more about the kids about these. So my teenagers, I see they're, all the movies they see is about extreme things, that New York getting, you know, swallowed by the sea, and extreme things that we know is not going to probably really happen in our lifetime, but I don't see anything like gradual teaching the kids on
A lot of social psychologists will tell you that if you want to get a message across to parents, you should go after the kids. So that's like the first point. The second thing is that I have a lot of respect for the media, because when some of our work came out, which looked at misperceptions of energy consumption, a lot of the people that picked up the story actually said, all right, these are the misperceptions, these are how you correct the perceptions, and this is what we should be doing about how to decrease individual energy consumption. So there's a lot of literature out there about what individuals can do, and I think that that is really important, because if you have a story that says, all right, we're stupid, we don't know what to do, that sort of leaves people, you know, really sort of scratching their heads, thinking like, all right, what should I be doing? I don't want to feel like a drop in the bucket. So I think providing people with actual items, actual things that they can do, is really, really powerful, and that's why I have a lot of respect for people in this room.
But Shaz's work is really interesting. Just the one thing is getting people, you know, climate literate, then there's getting them motivated, but what's the right decision we can take? What's the right action? And there's a lot of ignorance on where you get the best energy bang for your buck, and that's where it's really interesting. And, you know, promo for Reed Shazim's papers. It really shows how the American public doesn't really know what the best thing to do is.
Jim Poyser at Alt Weekly in Indianapolis called NUVO, following up on the last bunch of questions, is there any research on whether true cost labeling, like we're doing in nutrition, is getting carb information making behavioral changes? And if it is working, couldn't we then do that with appliances, for example?
So I can also add to that a little bit. So Jim's question was about how could we relabel, for example, appliances or products so that would actually influence people's decision making. So there's this great paper by Larick and Saul about the MPG illusion. So the thing is, what they found in their paper is that the actual label, miles per gallon, is a pretty faulty label, because the relationship between miles per gallon is curvilinear rather than linear. So people don't really understand the relative fuel savings when you're buying a car. So he actually went and talked to the EPA about this, and they're trying to rebrand or relabel how we sell cars. A lot of people don't understand watts. They don't understand the difference between power and energy. So if you tell someone, all right, what is your computer rated at? They don't really know. So for example, what we use in our studies is using a light bulb as a reference point. So a lot of us buy lights. We know that a 100 watt light bulb uses 100 units of energy. So if I were to buy a device or an appliance, if I had a light bulb equivalent, that would make much more sense to me, rather than saying, all right, this is going to use X number of kilowatt hours per year. That doesn't quite make sense to me. So I think relabeling would be really powerful.
And you've got a great quiz you created. I took it and failed terribly. Even though I failed terribly, the response was really positive. Like, great job. You got 62% of the quiz. A general ballpark of possible correctness.
What about framing? So in the back, and then we'll go here, and then we'll go there. So.
Matthew Schwartz, I'm with the local NGO called South Florida Wildlife Association. And I was sort of just getting myself settled when I heard Shaheen answer the question about in-groups and out-groups, and there is no us and them in climate change and the technology. I disagree with that. I actually disagree with that. I guess that's because of the kinds of people I tend to find myself around, which is environmental activists. And for environmental activists, it's clearly us and them. And I think the reason is that we don't choose our technology. We just don't. When I was studying sociology, remember, the best predictor for the income of a child is the income of the parents. The best predictor of carbon footprint for a citizen of a country is the footprint of the country. All my friends who feel very guilty about driving and using different appliances and are very careful about what they use, their carbon footprint is far higher than the average person in Bolivia, in Burma, in Laos, wherever you go. So we are basically using the technology that's available in the culture that we're part of. But somebody is choosing that culture. I never thought about having a car until I got out of New York City. Taking public transportation was perfectly normal to me. Getting on a bus, even as a kid, I was thinking about today driving here. My family used to take 3 buses to visit my grandmother in a different part of Brooklyn that we lived in. We thought of nothing of it, changing 3 buses to get to where we had to go. But we don't do that here, because agriculture in South Florida is driving a car.
We're driving poorly.
That's true, too. And I very much appreciated your comments about what's threatening and what's not.
So do you have a question?
The question is there an us and them? And that's the way, I think of it as that. I think that there are corporations and there are people who are making the decisions on our energy future, and they're the them, and I'm part of the us, and we're trying to change the them, and there is a great divide there. So maybe you could just address that a little bit.
So when I was talking about the us and them, what I was referring to is our global climate, in that it's a common pool resource. That we're not fighting with someone else about the concentrations of CO2 within our...
Let me rephrase the question. FPNL is making a decision to build 2 nuclear plants on Biscayne Bay for $20 billion. That's their decision. They are the sole electrical producer for South Florida. They're making a decision for 6.5 million customers. What if those 6.5 million customers would rather spend that $20 billion on solar? They're not given that choice. So... yeah, there are people, there's a great debate there. People are making the decisions on these things that people have no control over whatsoever. If they produce nuclear plants, when I turn on my light, I'm getting nuclear energy through my light bulb. So
you bring up a very, very important point, and that is the structural and the physical barriers to energy conservation and moving towards green. So I just moved from Manhattan to Bloomington. I also had to buy a car, right? So it's very difficult when you're embedded in a system that's not sustainable to be sustainable. And so I completely agree with you about the fact that even though I'm, I know about the things that are green, I'm sort of are anchored to the fact that the average American sort of is responsible for 30 tons of carbon per year. And I'm always going to be tethered to that because I'm embedded in this unsustainable structure. And so part of the sort of challenge here is to look at the psychology, but also the physical characteristics of our system, and we need to change both.
Okay.
I think there's purposeful deception that goes on by oil lobbyists about information that stops the public from acting in more unison. So, but I think there's also, in the case of there's lots of town hall meetings that 99.999% of people don't go to. I mean, I'll take a benevolent dictator over an effective democracy personally, any day, because on, my definition of benevolent. Right? These kind of FPL decisions, we're the public. There are requests for comment. I mean, it's weak. There's lots of politics behind it. I know some of these people in the room live this politics, but we're marching on Wall Street now, decide that's good or bad, but we're to blame for a lot of this as well.
In the purple shirt there, yes.
Yeah, I'm Tony Davis from the Arizona Daily Star. I could be wrong here, but the perception I'm getting from this discussion is there's an assumption that seems to be that the problem with the whole political climate and the whole failure with doing much about climate change is in the message that the media is sending out, that society is sending out, and the environmentalists are sending out. And to the extent that it's a political issue and you have oil companies making huge contributions to members of Congress and other kinds of companies, and presidents not willing to go out on a limb and all that, are you guys saying that if we just simply change the phrase we use instead of saying climate change, do something else, it's going to change things?
Yeah.
Oh, it's coming out.
Doing things as simple as changing a phrase matters. So why don't you Dave Arnstein's study? Okay, all right. So, here's a study that was done now. It's been replicated with thousands of Americans. The question was, would you be willing to pay a surtax for air travel, for a gallon of gasoline, all the kind of carbon intensive stuff. And it was phrased exactly the same, except calling the charge a tax or an offset. So when they called it a tax, of course, Republicans were fairly strongly negative. Independents were still moderately negative. Democrats were slightly in favor. You ask the exact same question, this is done with thousands of people, and you call it an offset versus a tax. It flips, and Republicans are actually positive, independents positive, and Democrats slightly more positive. So that's one word. Are people stupid? I mean, you can interpret it in different ways, but that's all it was, a changing word. So that kind of framing can matter. Now, will it last? Look at the transcripts of how they talk to each other. It's pretty ridiculous.
So we have only 2 minutes, so I need an SEJ member who has not asked a question yet. Is there anyone here?
Yeah. What clarification? Who did that study?
Hardesty, HARDESTY, which, can we do a commercial break? Because the center that we work with has it's called Psychological Guides. It's got a better title than what I'm saying, but if you talk to us, we'll give you the website, and it has all the citations for the kind of stuff we're talking about, examples, and many more of these cognitive biases. We'd love to share it. You're supposed to be here, there are 1,000 copies somewhere.
Somewhere, there are 1,000 copies.
Yeah.
We haven't found them.
I'm sure we'll bring them to the certified.
Okay, And
as a news person, I struggle with this every day of the idea of how to write a story for a general audience that addresses those different frameworks so you can keep that audience engaged without writing a textbook. And so we have responsibility to do the best job we can do to our work. But then in a culture where retweets and have the attention span of a gnat, I don't know, would you have suggestions for us?
I think this is more about education in general than about. I don't think as media you can't do much about this, unless you maybe give people further readings or something if they want to. But I mean, it's true. These stories always have to be short, so otherwise nobody reads them.
You can hyperlink on websites. I think that people who are reading it online, or you know, even when you tweet, you can say, "Did the story today inspired by this cool research?" And, you know, the internet's a great way, I think, to encourage people to have more.
Definitely, and on a slightly more negative note, the only people that are going to click through are the people that are already environmental projects. So it's really difficult to reach exactly those people that are the problem.
So we are at
home. Not at the note.
It's
can you say something funny?
Right, say something funny. So we can
Thank you.
Thank you so much.